Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Chibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffee Grande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Chibo-Filiale und auf chibo.de.
Coming up on Stu Does America, author Michael Schellenberger joins us to share his absolutely insane theory about climate change and how it's not going to eliminate the human race. And Jason Buttrell, head writer and researcher of the Glenn Beck Program, shares his insights on former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Join us in our battle against the YouTube algorithm robots by subscribing to our channel there, commenting on the videos, and hitting the thumbs up like button right now, this instant. Do it right now, please. What are you waiting for? If you've listened to me talk for more than 2 minutes, you know that I absolutely cannot abide climate change alarmists. Well, tonight, a very special guest will help me deliver a very huge I told you so, kind of. Don't miss it. Starts now.
Stu Does America.
Have you ever gone to a giant amusement park like Disney? And you park your car, you take the long walk through the parking lot. Then you arrive at a bus that shuttles you to a tram that brings you to the ticket line. And then you buy your ticket, wait through the line to get in, and then by then you have to go to the bathroom. There's another line, another long walk to another long line. You finally ride a roller coaster, and then it's lunchtime. That's pretty much how it goes. That's how it feels right now, you know, just living life. We're constantly shuttling from crisis to crisis, and we never seem to be able to find the fun part of life. One crisis that is omnipresent is the climate catastrophe. Always right there, but, you know, simultaneously right around the corner. We've been told for decades that this is the biggest threat we face as a nation and a people. Not a possible global pandemic. No preparations to be done there. That was way down the list. The climate eclipses everything. At least that's how we're supposed to think. But does that make any sense? I first became aware of Michael Schellenberger about 7 years ago when he appeared in a documentary called Pandora's Promise. He was a climate activist that was a rare breed, someone who took the climate seriously and was brave enough to say the thing you're not allowed to say, that solving our climate challenges is only possible if we take nuclear power seriously. He does go through nuclear power in the book with access to some of the world's top climate scientists. The book is out today, by the way. He quotes MIT's Carrie Emanuel, for example. They can't have it both ways, said MIT climate scientist Carrie Emanuel. If they say this climate change is apocalyptic or it's an unacceptable risk, then they have to turn around and rule out one of the most obvious ways of avoiding it, nuclear power. They're not only inconsistent, they're insincere. This new book isn't just about nuclear power, though. It shows that the apocalyptic alarmism of activists and media is not only hyperbolic and ineffective, it's also just plain wrong. The book is called Apocalypse Never: Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's the type of thing you're going to refer back to over and over again. It's an important book from a brave guy who is going to get trashed constantly for it. We need to support people willing to stick their neck out like this. Welcome to the program, Michael Schellenberger.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. You know, I've followed your work for a long time now, and I've considered you one of the more important people in this debate because you're able to actually approach it from a side of understanding, I think, that many don't have. You tweeted this today, though. I found it interesting. You say, on behalf of environmentalists, I apologize for the climate scare. The climate change is real, but it's not the end of the world. It's not even our most important environmental problem. I am delivering my apology in the form of a book. I hope you accept it. What are you apologizing for, Michael?
Well, I played a role in scaring people. I don't think I was as bad as some people, but I certainly framed climate change as an existential crisis. I suggested that it was, you know, a threat to human civilization and humankind. It's really not. At least nothing scientific could be said like that. And I became very concerned last year, in part because I have a 14-year-old daughter, and she's fine because I explained the science to her, but her friends are very scared. A lot of adolescents around the world felt like they wouldn't grow up to be able to have kids. They, girls were crying in London. One out of five British children have nightmares. And this is wrong. And it's not, climate change is not the end of the world. In fact, the news on climate change has been getting better because it appears as though we're reducing emissions much faster. I mean, most people don't know that most rich countries have been reducing their emissions for several decades. The United States have been reducing its emissions for almost 15 years. So there's just a lot, you know, we've been reducing the number of deaths from natural disasters for 100 years by 90%. So there's just a lot of good news that people should know. There's a lot of challenges as well, but I wouldn't consider really any of the biggest challenges to be climate change. Certainly not now, but probably not even in the past.
Well, the book is great. It's a great read. It's one of those I know I'm going to be going back to over and over and over again. I remember this stat on this page.
Thank you.
It does a great job explaining everything. I want to make sure that the people understand who you are, because first of all, the book is not a polemic by any means. You're not some conservative activist who is working for ExxonMobil. Tell people a little bit about your history, not just your activism recently, but also going back to when you were a teenager.
Well, sure. I was an environmental activist from the age of 16. I threw a fundraiser for Rainforest Action Network that year. So that was 33 years ago. I've worked on a lot of different causes. I've helped save California's last ancient redwoods, helped blow the whistle on factory conditions in Asia operated by Nike. I advocated a big renewables investment that President Obama made. I helped to make that happen, $90 billion. I've worked for everybody from Earth First to Sierra Club to NRDC. So I really care about this. This is my life's work. My mission has always been focused on both lifting people out of poverty and protecting the natural environment. And it's on that issue that I part company with some of my more alarmist colleagues who have used climate alarmism to deprive poor country the energy they need to develop, used it here to moralize on things that really don't matter very much environmentally, while opposing the things that actually are important for protecting the natural environment. So I wanted to, this is a long time coming. I don't write books every year. This is only my second book in 15 years. So there's a lot in here, a lot of stories about what life is like for the billions of people who don't have access to modern energy. So I want to bring that sensitivity in, because I just think we get very lost in our first world problems.
Yeah.
And we forget the fact that we're actually some of the most fortunate people on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. And you make a great case that both of these things actually can be done at the same time, and people can benefit as well as the environment. I want to start right where you start, which is you talk about a group, Extinction Rebellion, and they're kind of a theme throughout the book. You bring them up often. They are, I don't know, you'd see that like the crazy climate activists who bringing coffins into the streets and in the most flamboyant way possible. And you talk about them blocking traffic in, I think it was London. And it was an interesting perspective you had on it. As the media members questioned this group over and over again, they would say they would agree with their claims, but at the same time criticize things like blocking traffic. When you put those two together, it really doesn't make much sense, does it?
Right. I mean, if you think that billions of people are going to die, or even if you think that just millions of people are going to die, then blocking traffic seems like the least you could do. Like, why would you stop there? I mean, we laugh, but it's got some disturbing overtones. You know, I think there's sort of a sense by a lot of journalists. I mean, I have to say I was surprised. I mean, I started criticizing the alarmism last year. The most common question I got from journalists, I won't name any names, but some prominent ones, was, hey, isn't some exaggeration necessary to get people's attention? Here's the problem with that. First of all, they've been exaggerating this for 30 years, so you can't have it both ways. You can't say that nothing's been done for 30 years and we haven't been alarmists. We've been alarmists for 30 years. Mm-hmm. But there's another problem with it, is that when you start escalating these claims so that you go, you know, millions, billions, it starts to lead you to justifying some pretty reprehensible behaviors, particularly redirecting World Bank money away from things that lift people out of poverty to things like democracy workshops, charitable activities that are not critical to economic growth. There's a lot of environmentalists that are just against economic growth. I think they forgot that we all became very wealthy, secure, prosperous, free people. You know, a lot of environmentalists are feminists, women's rights advocates, gay rights advocates. There are no women's rights in a society that's really poor. Mm. You know, there are not rights for minorities, racial or sexual minorities in poor societies. So the characters in my book are mostly women. They're often women of color, poor people. So this is not a right wing book. This is not a book that lets liberals off the hook. It says if you really believe in you know, what you might call humanistic values, values that put people first, then you can't justify many of the behaviors that climate alarmists have been perpetrating for the last 3 decades.
Yeah, I mean, just the journey of Bernadette and Supartie in the book it's a fascinating way to illustrate how this affects real people. I want to hit quickly. You blew my mind a couple of times right near the beginning of the book where this sort of thing played out. A quote, a claim from environmentalists that I've heard a million times. I've seen quoted and parroted by media sources a million times. Take that claim and you go to the scientist who is responsible for the claim, and multiple times they tell you, actually, that was a misquote. I didn't even say that. I mean, that is an absolutely fascinating thing that happens at least 2 or 3 times right near the beginning of the book. That was an incredible thing to go through. Did you expect to hear we're talking about misquotes?
Yeah, I mean, there's some pretty bad behavior here. I mean, I wrote this book in the simplest way possible because I wanted my 14-year-old daughter to read it. I wanted kids to be able to read it. Because, you know, look, if they have to choose between, you know, an old guy like me and Greta Thunberg, they choose Greta Thunberg. So I felt like, well, I got to put the data together and I'm going to go interview, because Greta Thunberg says, listen to the scientists. Mm. Well, she's listening to basically 3 or 4 apocalyptic, radical left scientists. I interviewed them. And I'll tell you the thing that was really disappointing about those conversations is how quickly each of them attempted to blame journalists for having misquoted them. It was almost like an intuitive response, you know, and one of the claims was, I don't see how the planet could sustain 500 million people. Okay. There's 7.5 billion people right now. The quote was, I don't see how the world could sustain 500 million people. Well, the scientists who I interviewed said, oh, I was misquoted. What I said was, I don't see how the Earth could sustain 500 million people. Well, it's still claiming that billions of people are going to die. Why are you even? It just got to the point of being so pseudoscientific. And so, yeah, I did actually get to the bottom of the really hysterical claims. But there's other ones. I mean, this idea that the Brazilian Amazon rainforest is the lungs of the world. It was never true. It has been debunked since the 60s, it turns out. It was debunked actually when I was a kid in the 80s. And in fact, in the early readers of this book, I debunked it too quickly. The readers said they just couldn't get over it. So I added this very long paragraph. I thought it was boring about how the oxygen respiration cycle works. And it just shows, I think. I mean, by the way, it's New York Times, CNN, it's mainstream media that said the Amazon is the lungs of the world. First of all, it doesn't make any sense because the lungs, of course, absorb oxygen and emit carbon. Right. The Amazon absorbs carbon. So, but that kind of stuff is shockingly common. I mean, I don't know other issues like healthcare or all the other issues that we debate. But in this case, it's really almost the case that everything people think about the environment is wrong. We've been misinformed.
Yeah, and it was really interesting, and I think you have a real advantage over any other book I've read, you know, that has any relation to the topic that you're talking about here, in that these scientists took you seriously. I think a lot of times, you know, when you come out with something critical towards science, they reflexively bring it back to partisanship or you're anti-science or whatever it is. All these, you could tell that they respected you, they took you seriously, and they tried to answer your claims. At least that was the impression I got from the book. And over again, you put them in places that I think made them uncomfortable. But instead of the reflexive answer of you're anti-science, they can't really pull that off with you. Did you feel that like that was an advantage as far as trying to get to the truth on this stuff?
Oh yeah, I mean the only reason I never did this earlier is that I always thought that somebody in the scientific community would do this work, and they kept not doing it, you know. And I got an invitation from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change last year to be an invited expert reviewer of their reports. I'm very sure that that came from people inside IPCC who understand that they have a problem of credibility because of all the alarmist messages they put out over the years. So, I think people are willing to talk to you if you're, I read a column for Forbes and, I usually call these guys and, I think that the thing I'll say about the book is that I always try to bring out the best in everybody I interviewed. And so, one of the people I actually really liked was this woman who's famous for having pulled the plastic straw out of the sea turtle nose. Mm-hmm. It's this viral video. She and I got on the phone. We were on the phone together for an hour and a half. And I really respect her and what she's doing. And I respect her marine biology work. At the end of it, though, we had an argument about she thinks that private companies like Coca-Cola should be responsible for recycling activities in poor countries. I think that mostly we're going to deal with waste problems in the way that we've always done with it, which is that there's a centralized waste repository system. But I wanted to bring that into the book, which is to sort of say, hey, there's actually a lot of good people working on this. Some people have some ideas that aren't quite right, but it's certainly not a book where I was trying to kind of just find, the bad part of people. I always was looking for both the good and the bad.
Mm. Let's take a quick break. I want to come back on the other side with more. Let me leave you with quote two, if I could, if you guys could bring that one up, since we're talking about plastics. The plastics parable teaches us that when we save nature by not using it, and we avoid using it by switching to artificial substitutes. It's a totally different way to think about this stuff, but it's a very important way. The book is called Apocalypse Never. Back with more of the author, Michael Schellenberger, in just a second. We're back with Michael Schellenberger, author of Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. Let me give you another quote here. This is number eight, guys. Today's rich nations should do everything they can to help poor nations industrialize. Instead, many of them are doing something closer to the opposite, seeking to make poverty sustainable rather than to make poverty history. This is such a powerful argument you make throughout the book, that this is not about, big oil companies. It's not about making the environment better for the environment's sake. We want to make the earth better for people's sake, and specifically those who have a real chance of developing and coming along that are in really dangerous situations right now, not a century into the future. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, this was a huge motivation for writing this book. I guess if there was two big motivations, one, it was to provide teenagers, young people with the facts because they've been so badly misled. And then the other one was to stick up for these poor countries that are basically being denied cheap forms of energy, which are essential to develop, by rich nations, which control the purse strings of the World Bank and other international development banks. I mean, it's outrageous, that Mozambique was allowed to export their natural gas to Europe, but what, we're not going to support them in building natural gas power plants that can provide electricity for their people? This is just outrageous. And this is actually the mainstream environmental movement is supporting these policies. I'm talking about the Sierra Club, for example, Greenpeace, but also the European Union. So there's no justification for this. I explain in the book how economic development works. It's so simple. All it is people going from being small farmers, small subsistence farmers, to living in the city, many of them working in factories, eventually working office jobs. And, I make this point that, we all used to be small farmers. Now just 2% of us work in farming. How do we do that? We do it the same way almost everywhere. I mean, unless you have a bunch of oil and you're Saudi Arabia or something, most countries develop by having factories, and we call that industrialization. We also produce more food on less land. Well, now you have the entire United Nations Development Program, United Nations Environment Program, encouraging countries to stick with small farming, like trying to basically, here, have a solar panel, and you can stay in your village. It's very upsetting. It's the soul of this book. It's why the central character is Bernadette, who, as you mentioned, is a woman in the Congo and in Africa, and she needs a big hydroelectric dam. Well, guess who's stopping them? My neighbors in Berkeley. And where is all of our electricity coming from? Hydroelectric dams. Mm. So you can see, I get very upset about it. It's disturbing, and especially since we did have this commitment, just like 10 years ago, Bono and all those famous rock stars We're promoting this campaign called Make Poverty History. Whatever happened to that? It got taken over by the climate alarmists, who apparently the thing they're most successful at, since they're not able to stop economic growth in wealthy countries, they're able to deprive poor countries the energy they need to develop. I just think it's unconscionable, and I had to speak out against it.
Yeah, and it's really important that you do that. And I think part of that is getting the truth out about a lot of these claims. Let me just give the audience a few of them that we go through, because unfortunately we don't have a time to break them all down, but they're all broken down in the book with tons of sourcing, everything that you need. You mentioned Earth's lung. That's not an actual thing. The paper straws, plastic straws thing is vital to my future, because that's the sort of thing I will lose my mind. If I have to have another paper straw, I will completely lose my mind. That's separate from your book, but it's true. Sweatshops, are they evil or do they save the Earth? You make the case that they actually are helping people. Who saved the whales? Not Greenpeace, but capitalism twice, as you go through in the book. If you know this debate, you know Natalie Orsekes, who is you talk about her work in there and some misleading things is there as well. Polar bears, we've heard so much about them. And you actually go through and you have some really fascinating parts. You know, I kind of came to learning about you and your work when you did you worked on a documentary several years ago called Pandora's Promise. And you actually helped me set a rule, which is I don't take environmentalists seriously unless they're actually seriously considering nuclear energy, because it is really important. If you really care, this is a real solution. You go back to the history of the nuclear power stuff and find a great quote from Ralph Nader, which I had never heard before. And it crystallized how these debates change over time so significantly. This is quote 7, guys. We do not need nuclear power, said Nader. We have a far greater amount of fossil fuels in this country than we're owning up to. The tar sands, oil out of shale, methane in coal beds. The Sierra Club's energy consultant, Amory Lovins, wrote, coal can fill the real gaps in our fuel economy with only a temporary and modest expansion of mining. This is coming from environmentalists. It seems like it's another world. But these things change so quickly, and I think a lot of times it's based on our opinion of ourselves, that our arguments are perfect every single time, and we're not willing to look at new technologies and exciting things when they do develop. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, I mean, this book really has, you know, it's divided really into three parts. The first part is a debunking of environmental alarmism. That's like the first four chapters. And then the next five chapters are about how humans save nature. And that's where we talk about why cities are important, why industrialization is important, why substituting artificial products for natural products is important to saving nature. And then the last three chapters look at why is it that we came to see these manageable environmental problems as the end of the world. And that is really about money, power, and religion. And ultimately, I think environmentalism is a religion for people that think that they're secular. We do know that hardcore environmentalists do tend to be more secular. And I draw on a bunch of the psychological research, which shows that people really need to believe in something. Like, people need to have a faith in something. And for a lot of people, you know, having kids and grandkids is enough to feel like have some kind of, that you live on after you die. But for people, you know, that maybe don't have that, or for whom that's not enough, or whom don't believe that there's an afterlife, they start to construct a kind of morality and a kind of cosmology that leads them to be very dogmatic. And so that's why when environmentalists are so dogmatic and so wrong at the same time, I think there's something going on that suggests they're motivated by more of a religious impulse than by a rational one.
Yeah, and you make a good argument, too, about how the money flows, which is really an interesting part of this equation as well. Let me ask you this last one here before we leave. Some of the book is just really raw. I mean, you could tell that there's a big chunk of you in here, and it's emotional at times. This is the number, quote 9, guys. I was drawn toward the apocalyptic view of climate change 20 years ago. I can see now that my heightened anxiety about climate change reflected an underlying anxiety and unhappiness in my own life that had little to do with climate change or the state of the natural environment. Really, I was struck that this feels like almost like a defining work for you. Is that what it feels like?
Yeah, that's a very heavy sense.
I don't mean to throw that at you here at the end of the interview.
We could end
on a smile. But
Yeah. I mean, that last chapter was very hard to write. And, you know, I'm making a criticism of what I think is an unhealthy psychology behind environmentalism. And at the end, I couldn't figure out how to do it because I didn't want to be guessing as to other people's motivations. And so I just talked about my own experience. And yeah, like I said, I think when I was really apocalyptic about climate change, it was due to some unhappiness that didn't have anything to do with the natural environment. And I'm not saying that's how it is for everybody, but that's how it is for me. And I hope that people, when they find themselves, you know, preaching the end of the world in 12 years, they'll just give a consideration to whether maybe that what they're worried about maybe isn't the climate and maybe something else going on in their lives.
Really? I mean, it's an excellent book. It's a book you I can't recommend it highly enough.
Michael Schellenberger. Thank you so much. Yeah, I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you for doing this. And thank you. It's a brave thing to do. I'm sure your life's going to be a little miserable here. I hope you recognize that here for the next few months. I hope that isn't the case. But it seems to be when people speak out, it's not always as welcomed as I would hope it would. So please be strong, and we'd love to have you back on at another time to go through even more of the book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. It's Michael Schellenberger. The book is Apocalypse Never: Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. As I said earlier, when people step out and are brave like this, we need to support them. Go get this book. I can't recommend it highly enough. Michael, thanks for coming on the program. Back in a second. All right. Look, we just went through a quarantine. And was it fun? No, it was not fun. It was, and I don't even know. Are we even coming out of it? Seems like we're going to get everything banned once again. Intermittent fasting is a way to, people talk about losing weight. And if you need to lose weight, maybe you put on 19 pounds in the COVID-19 quarantine. You're not alone on that. I think you might like this strategy, though. It's a little bit different. I always feel like the normal approach to losing weight is, oh, you go out and you just exercise 3 or 4 hours a day, and you just cut off a few hundred calories every single meal of every single day and eat healthy and be unhappy and don't like eat things that you like. That's not sustainable. I feel like I'd rather, when I'm into it, I'm into it. And so it's a big situation when it comes to setting rules and being able to follow them. Intermittent fasting is easy, though, with FastBlast. It's a lot easier than trying to do it on your own, I can tell you that. They will walk you through every step of this so you understand how it works, as well as these give you these great smoothies, which the smoothies are awesome, and they fill you up, and it doesn't feel like you're suffering. I'll be honest with you. It makes it a lot easier. So I would definitely recommend going with FastBlast, but it's an interesting thing to consider. I always tell you to do your own homework. Urge you to learn up more about this at FastBlast.com/Blaze. Get started today with FastBlast. Let them walk you through this process. FastBlast.com/Blaze. Get started today for a healthier and smaller you. It's FastBlast.com/Blaze. Comedy genius Carl Reiner is dead, 98 years old. People remember him for the Dick Van Dyke Show. Although I will say, and this is something that actually happened to me today. I saw the news and I thought, oh, it's the guy behind the Jerk, Steve Martin movie. And then I said, nope, don't say that out loud. Because if people remember The Jerk, there's no way it doesn't get canceled. We are totally screwed. I mean, it's a classic movie, has all sorts of offensive things in it. And you got to believe it's going to get canceled now that people are remembering it again. And that's sad. I will say this, and this is legitimately true. There are several shows that I can think of that I really enjoy that have made edgy commentaries on things like race, being critical of racism and sexism and all sorts of other bad, nasty things. I hesitate to bring them up in any public context because even when they have the right intentions and even when what they did is completely fine and all of that, they still are getting canceled these days. I mean, Cops got canceled because they feature people in the same job as somebody who did something wrong. I have no idea what the rules are anymore, so I'm hiding all the names of my favorite shows from now on. But rest in peace, Carl Reiner. Back in a second. How often do you find yourself mentally checking out at work? Now, I know you're doing this show all the time, but do you do it at work as well? It's not good there. How about that all too often afternoon crash that coffee just can't fix? Well, you need Dawn to Dusk. Dawn to Dusk is a physician-formulated extended-release energy supplement, which lasts up to 10 hours. It increases energy, improves your mood, and stimulates your brain, all with no jitters. Some of these things, they make you feel weird. That's not the case with Dawn to Dusk. It's safe, effective, and a lot less expensive than all those expensive drinks, especially if you're getting them at Starbucks, like $47 a drink. Right now, save 15% off a one-month supply. Use my code STU at dawntodusk.com. The code is STU. Make sure to use the code STU because that's how they know you like this stupid show. Dawn to Dusk, it's mydawntodusk.com. Code is STU. Welcome, Jason Buttrell. He's head writer and researcher of the Glenn Beck Program right here on Blaze TV. Jason, thanks for stopping by. Russia has been an interesting sort of world over the past 4 years. We found out, of course, Vladimir Putin single-handedly gave Donald Trump the election. We know that to be a fact. at least in the media, I seem to know that. But it doesn't seem like Vladdy was so friendly with the United States there for a while. We're getting reports now of a bounty system. Is this true, do you think, and is it common?
Okay, well, so first off, there's so many different things to talk about here. First off, it's being used, this story is being used to say that, you know, the Trump administration's going light on Russia again. That's their angle on this.
Yes.
It's like, oh, an investigation needs to be done. I saw John Bolton, which I think we might talk about here in a second. He was even saying that. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many times we have to say this. The Trump administration has not been light on Russia.
No.
They've been far more, active than the Obama administration was. They all say they want to seek a reset with Russia. Every single administration since forever has said that. I got news for you. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. We're just never going to get along. But the fact that Russia might have been giving bounties to the Taliban to take out coalition forces would not surprise me whatsoever. Back in my day, right after 9/11, I was in Afghanistan. There was a bounty on, I think it was a $100,000 bounty on U.S. soldiers back then. I think it was $25,000 just for a uniform. We knew it. I think some people might have talked about it. I don't ever remember the Bush administration publicly coming out and talking about it. Why? Because these things are dark. They happen all the time and they're never spoken about.
I will say, if I was in the military, I would seriously consider selling my uniform for $25,000.
I mean,
I lost it again.
Might have looked for a few pallets. Can you get me a pallet? Yeah. but yeah, these things are not spoken about, but they happen. There's never a public, you know, tit for tat in things like this, because this is, you know, kind of like an act of war.
It seems like an act of war. I hope we're not doing things like that. I've never heard us being accused of it, though other groups around the world are. But it reminded me sort of our cyber warfare stance, right?
Right.
Like, we're obviously doing things in the cyber realms that we don't necessarily want to discuss publicly, but clearly are going on. And there's stuff like that's going on all the time with the military.
But right.
It's usually not like it was such a bloodthirsty sort of thing.
Right. And for instance, we've talked about, I know Glenn has a lot about what was going on in Ukraine. We know that the Obama administration wanted to fight the Ukrainians, but their public stance was, we're only going to give non-lethal aid. Now, is that really what was going on? I tend to doubt it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there was something we just don't know about. But anyway, the point is, these things happen all the time. But I question this a lot. For instance, the New York Times, for their reasoning, said that the purpose that the GRU, that's their military intelligence in Russia.
Formerly the KGB, basically, right?
No, these are actually different. There's multiple intelligence agencies, right. Shady ones in Russia.
Yes.
This one's just the military arm of their intelligence. But they said their reasoning was because they wanted us to sign this peace deal with the Taliban. So they're like, and when you try to do the mental gymnastics in this, it makes no sense, because it would probably have the exact opposite effect.
Yeah.
You start killing us, we're going to go in deeper onto this.
Yep. So, like, we all want to leave these areas, but, you know, we get pissed off when they come after our guys.
That's the one thing that would make us not.
It's the one thing that makes us stay. Yeah.
Right. But the president just tweeted out, I think maybe 2 days ago, that said that he just talked to the DNI, the current DNI. And he said that the DNI confirmed that this was never in your presidential brief because it was based off of information that we couldn't corroborate. So that's a big distinction, and it kind of also, I mean, the Steele dossier should have never been briefed to the president, should not have been in the presidential's daily brief.
Right.
Because it was uncorroborated information.
Yep.
They did it anyway. This is another example of that. I was an intelligence analyst when I was in the Marines. We would get information all the time that was uncorroborated. If it's uncorroborated, you can't nail it down. You do not brief that to the general. It's the same with the president.
Right. You don't want to influence their actions on something that may or may not be true.
Right. It could be just false information that Russia was throwing out there to try and influence decision making.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been. So that's basically where that was at right now. The big question now is, why was it leaked? Why was it leaked right now? It seems fairly obvious. It seems like there's still people that are in the intelligence apparatus, it goes all the way through the State Department. I won't say the, I'll just say it, deep state word.
Yeah.
But there are still people up there that do not like the administration, that want to do things to try and paint him in a different light. And in the case of this, it's the tired, same old thing that he's going light on Russia. Why did he not do anything about that? Well, there's multiple reasons why he wouldn't. One, it's uncorroborated. You can't talk about it.
Right.
Two, it is happening. We can't come out with it publicly. We're responding to it. But to come out publicly would be it basically acknowledging that we're at war with Russia and Afghanistan.
Right.
Which we're not doing.
We prefer to stay away from that. We got enough going on.
I don't know. Right.
Let me switch gears a little bit to Bolton. The Bolton book has been out now for a week. It is, I've been reading it. It's interesting. I think you'd like it because it goes really in depth on, you know, the back and forth before the Helsinki press conference, or the back and forth between the pulling out of Syria and all these different things. Bolton's an interesting character because he's been, generally speaking, admired by the right his entire career, at least as long as he's been in the public eye. He's obviously very smart guy. He's very well read. He knows these issues. He's been in the middle of all of them for 20 or 30 years. He goes into the Trump administration, and from day one, it's not a good fit with the Trump administration. Because he doesn't align. Trump basically is an isolationist when it comes to this stuff.
It's exactly the opposite of what?
Exactly the opposite of Bolton. And so it was interesting to read it. I think, like, when it comes to Russia, one of the first things Bolton says in the book is that Trump was exonerated on Russia. So he's pretty clear on that. He does advocate for a stronger treatment of Putin, but it also acknowledges that the policy has been pretty difficult here. Like, they've done a lot against Russia, and for whatever reason, the media wants to focus on his personal words towards Putin rather than focusing on the policy, and that seems to be a side sort of way of just trying to find the one thing they can do to pick Trump apart on Russia rather than looking at the whole policy. In general.
Yeah, I like that criticism of, you know, whatever Trump says he's going to do is never really what he ends up doing.
Yeah,
his foreign policy has been the perfect example of that. Like, we saw it in North Korea, mm-hmm. where he's talking about fire and fury, and, you know, and I'm going to move in all these, you know, assets, and you will pay for it, you know, yada yada yada. But then what he always does, and this is basically the Trump doctrine at this point, is talk big. Threaten with use of the military,
yeah.
and then pull out, and then look for sanctions or look for some kind of something like that to counter it. It's never the John Bolton type of foreign policy. You mentioned that John Bolton was pretty much accepted on the right, and that's fairly true. But I would put a caveat, more of like the neocon portion of the right. They loved John Bolton. Mm-hmm. The more libertarian leaning did not like John Bolton, but that's kind of why I liked his addition to the White House.
Because pushes them in a different direction.
And it's a layer of unpredictability, it was, in the White House. Like, Trump would talk big. You knew that you had John Bolton there, which everyone assumed was guiding that big talk.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, while everyone's scared of, oh my gosh, what's Bolton going to do? He's going to invade. Trump administration, or President Trump himself, had never had an intention to.
Yeah, no, and that's true. I think you go through the book and you see that sort of thing repeated over and over again, where Bolton, you know, it's like Bolton definitely is a confident guy. Let's put it that way. He definitely thinks he's right about everything. And when you go through with the situation, you kind of realize that a lot of the things I think he is right on. Like him taking Islamic extremism seriously, him looking at the situation in Syria, I think he was right on it. But again, the president is the decision maker here. And I think Bolton eventually recognizes that and figures, what's the point of me sitting here? Because we're obviously in major disagreement. One thing I wanted to look at from the dynamic of this, because I thought this was a pretty interesting observation, and you being in the military all these years might have a little more insight on it than I do, because I have none. He's very critical of Mattis. Now, he first of all despises Nikki Haley. I mean, like, I think they might get in a fist fight next time they run into each other somewhere. But he does not like Mattis either. And one of the things he talks about with Mattis is this concept that he's essentially made himself a five-star general. Which was, you know, he's just, instead of actually being Secretary of Defense, he's just become a general that tells four-star generals what to do. And there's many, many of examples of it in the book. But he kind of comes to this point where Mattis believes he's the right one. He's going to do whatever he has to do. He's constantly manipulating the press and slow playing in a sort of a long bureaucracy, sort of taking people down these roads of bureaucracy that actually sidetrack what Trump's trying to do. This is one of the reasons why it seems like you don't put military people in these roles, right? Because then he's so, and this is Bolton's case, neither side, the civilian side or the military side, don't work well under this circumstance because they have different goals and they have different ways of looking at the world. Is that something that you can kind of see could be a problem when it comes to these levels?
Well, I mean, I see his point. What I think is interesting is everything he's saying about Mattis was everything wrong with him in his position there. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. They both, I know General Mattis. I served under him in Afghanistan. They both think that they're exactly right, and they're going to try to convince everybody that they're right. So you can see why Bolton and Mattis did not get along there. It's like two roosters should not be in that hen house together like that. They're going to fight.
Yeah.
I loved the appointment of General Mattis.
I was a fan of it at the time as well.
The thing was, is he was a, so he's a very, you know, traditionalist when it comes to military policy. And so I thought he was going to be a very grounding, you know, presence that was going to keep things rolling in a certain direction. The thing is that now we're seeing that he was clashing with Trump, because if Trump wanted to do something different, Mattis was having a issue with it, and now he's being very vocal about it.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, one of the things they keep coming back to is this sort of like idea that there was the adults in the room, right?
Yeah.
The adults in the room were the Mattises and the Kellys and all these guys who came in at the beginning and tried to control Trump. And Bolton is actually really critical of that, saying that basically they caused a reaction in Trump after he sort of realize what was going on, which they were slow playing all that. They'd say, yes, of course we'll do that. And they wouldn't do it because they were the smart ones and Trump wasn't. It caused a reaction the other way with Trump, where he started acting more erratically because he didn't want those guys around. He didn't like that they were doing that to him. And I think that you can't run a government that way. You know, whether you like Trump or not, he's the president of the United States. He's running the military. He's the guy. So get on board with what he's doing, or you need to go somewhere else.
Yeah,
that's the system.
Yeah, and I don't understand the way the Trump administration was built, because it was built off of this maverick, right?
Yeah.
That this guy that was going to upend certain institutions, do things differently.
Mm-hmm.
Then he goes and hires a bunch of established people that are that's what their job was to get him in line.
Yeah, yeah.
So I love Mattis, but his job, I guarantee you, was to keep Trump in line, to keep things rolling in the direction. Bolton wanted the same thing, basically. He wanted things going in that, I would say, neocon worldview of toe that line.
And he's very honest about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a matter of, like, at some point, and I think you're right, Trump liked Bolton's reputation because it gave weight to his threats. You know, but in the end, it just wasn't a working relationship that could really go on. I mean, there's so much more to talk about this. We'll do this again here coming up here as maybe if you could read the book and I'll continue to finish it. It's been the media has used it as 100% Trump bashing, and that's all they're getting out of it. But there's a lot more there, and some of it's really interesting. Jason Buttrell, he's a head writer and researcher for the Glenn Beck Program. Thanks for coming on the show. Also, don't forget to enjoy, of course, Jason, who's on this show, News and Why It Matters, all the time, and on Glenn Beck, the TV show. Go to blazetv.com/stew. Use the promo code Stew, because that's how they know you like this stupid show, and it'll take $10 off the cost. Back in a second. Your reviews on iTunes are the only thing that can save the world. This one comes in and says, I love this stupid show. It's great. Whatever. 5 freaking stars. There, I did it. I know it won't stop his begging, but at least my conscience is clear. That's true. Also, I mean, I only listen to it every night before I go to bed, so it's great. Whatever. Cool. 5 freaking stars. Love you guys. Thank you so much for taking the time to review on iTunes. We'll see you tomorrow.